geological surveys and excavations. In the next couple of weeks, we'll be going into surveys and especially excavations in depth and dealing in depth with the different time periods. But these will be just some introductory remarks. And then we'll go through the, as the lecture schedule indicates, through the archaeological periods represented in Jordan. And I thought it might be more interesting, rather than just going through the sheets and giving you dates, that as we go through that chronological list of periods represented in Jordan, we look at just a few quick examples of sites in Jordan. Okay, for archaeological survey, certainly a simple definition would be the main purpose of an archaeological survey is to locate and date ancient sites by means of surface examination. Now, if you've never studied any archaeology at all, you might be surprised by the fact that you can date a site, usually the whole history of the site, not necessarily, but quite often the whole history of a site, just by walking over the surface. Obviously, as we talked last time about the formation of tells, in general, the youngest material or the latest material is on top, and the lowest material is on the bottom. On the other hand, on the sides of a tell, especially if there's been very much erosion, sherds from those lower levels will erode out, and especially if there's a deep cut in the tell, you'll often find pottery from all periods of occupation represented on the surface. Also, of course, you will generally find a dominance of pottery from the latest occupation, since that's the closest to the surface. Dating of sites by means of a surface survey is usually done on the basis of pottery, although to a certain extent, architecture can also be used for dating. Obviously, if you have find a nice Corinthian capital on the surface, you know that it's a Hellenistic Roman site rather than a Paleolithic site. But pottery is by far the most important means of dating on surface survey. There are a number of reasons for conducting surveys. One of them is, surprisingly enough, even though people have been doing archaeology in Jordan for the last 50 years, there are major sectors of the country that haven't been surveyed. That is, we really don't know what archaeological sites are there. The desert is one of those areas. By far the largest territory in Jordan. We, of course, know about the Maya desert castles and large structures, but there are undoubtedly thousands of so far unidentified prehistoric sites in the desert. Identifying those sites and putting them on the map is important for scholarly reasons in terms of trying to figure out settlement patterns. That is, in different archaeological periods, people were living and moving in different regions. But there's a more practical reason, or a less esoteric reason these days, and that is because modern development is proceeding so rapidly in Jordan that sites are being destroyed. The desert is one example. They're putting a new road right across from Sahab that will go very near Qasr Qurana and Amra, and one of the concerns has been that there has not been enough time to get an archaeological survey out there, so we really don't know at this point how many prehistoric sites might have been destroyed by that construction. So it's very often archaeologists are conducting surveys immediately in front of the bulldozers trying to identify sites to so the contractors can be advised how to avoid, or where a site is and how to avoid it. Hopefully we're going to get ahead of the game one of these days, and that is conduct our surveys 2 or 3 years before projects get into the field so the contractors can make their plans earlier. That's at least what we're striving for right now. As Jerry mentioned the last time when he was talking about the Moab survey, or Max Miller's survey between the Wadi Mujib and the Wadi Hassa, one of the reasons that they were conducting that site was not only to identify possibly endangered sites, but also to check on the results of previous explorers. Because if you go back and check a site, just a surface survey, you'll very often find either that an early explorer didn't pick up all the pottery or not that you have to pick up all the pottery, but he didn't recognize pottery from certain periods of occupation. Or there's always a possibility that he picked up pottery and misidentified it. And sometimes those identifications can be quite wrong. For example, early bronze pottery dating from 3000 BC can fairly easily be confused with Ottoman pottery, which is only 200 or 300 years old. So checking the results of earlier explorers is an important reason for doing the survey. Also, choosing a site for excavation. Hardly any archaeologist in the field today would go out without doing a surface survey and say, that's the site I want to dig. Especially with the lack of funds, if you're interested in digging, for example, a middle bronze site, surveys will often try to concentrate on one period sites. Obviously, if you can go to a site that has only middle bronze pottery on it, that would be a good site to dig if you're interested in problems relating to the middle bronze age. Whereas if you go to a site that has Ottoman pottery on the top and Umayyad pottery going through back through all of the Islamic periods, Umayyad, Mamluk, Ayyub, and so forth, you might have to dig through 5 meters of soil before you get into the middle bronze layer. So if you are interested in a one period site or a particular time period, a surface survey can be very important in determining which site you want to dig with your limited financial resources. And the fifth reason for doing a surface survey is that once you have identified the site that you want to excavate, a very careful survey can often tell you where you want to dig. That is, if you're interested in an Iron Age iron smelting and you have a nice Iron Age site, a careful surface survey will very often pinpoint areas of concentration of slag, which could help to identify, without doing any digging, where the smelting process was taking place on the site. Also, you can sometimes, very often, identify areas of occupation, public areas by both the pottery and architecture and so forth. So it's a great time saver to intensively excavate a site once you've decided that you do want to survey it. We've got a couple tapes upstairs, given two lectures that were given by our Albright fellow Ted Banning on survey procedures or techniques, and so I won't go into that right now. If you are interested in the different types of surveys, full coverage surveys or random surveys or purposive surveys, there's just about as many different ways of organizing and conducting a survey as there are archaeologists, and quite an interesting arguments back and forth as to which is the most proper, which gives you the best and most reliable samples. In the early days, a lot of the surface surveys were covered just by two or three people going out and walking alongside of each other. That's still a lot of field walking is essential, but surveys these days also rely fairly heavily on satellite photographs and even more on aerial photographs. You need good contour maps, good geological maps. Very often having a geologist along with you is also very helpful in terms of identifying natural deposits and man-made deposits. As Jerry has emphasized, the accounts of previous explorers or archaeologists that have worked in an area are often a very important source of information. Also, information gathered from locals. It's kind of interesting when you hear an archaeologist talk about a survey that he went out and he discovered 500 new sites this year. Actually, over 1,000 sites have been discovered in recent years in Wadi Hassa, depending on how you define a site. It's true that they've been discovered by the Westerners, although a lot of the Westerners are simply going up to the locals and asking, are there antiquities in the area? And locals are taking you to the antiquity site. So, usually the locals in any particular area know if there are or are not antiquities. And within the last 10 years, locals are becoming much better at being able to identify antiquity sites. 15 years ago, if you would show certain flint tools to locals, they would say it's just a hadjar, just an ordinary rock. But with archaeologists swarming all over the country now, locals are beginning to recognize the antiquities in their area, and they're a very important source of information. One of the reasons that, several reasons, why archaeological surveys are growing in importance, as we've already mentioned, trying to keep up with modern development, there's one other very practical reason, and that is that archaeological surveys are much more inexpensive and much easier to organize than a full-scale excavation. So I think that's a very practical reason why you will see over the next 5 to 10 years more and more archaeological surveys being done, not necessarily less archaeological excavations, but the early days of the big massive sites with hundreds of workers on the sites trying to excavate the entire mound, those types of excavations are quickly going out, and again, primarily because of financial reasons. One point that I would like to emphasize, if you want to get an archaeologist really angry, all you need to do is, say, pull up to Acor with a truckload of pottery shards and saying, see what I've collected. Now, all of us go out and look at sites and pick up a few shards now and then. But there's a common misconception that surface pottery really isn't that important. It's only when you're excavating and having it in context that you can actually damage a site by sherding it or taking the sherds off the surface. That's true to a certain extent. The pottery that you find well stratified is most important because that helps date that particular strata. But it can also be very confusing for future archaeologists if they go to a site which 50 years ago had nice painted late bronze pottery on it, and you go today and you find absolutely no indication that there was any late bronze occupation, because people have come by and picked up all the nice painted pieces of pottery. And more this is becoming a problem, that sites are really becoming quickly denuded. So I would ask, if you ever go out and just see nice pottery, if you need to pick up any, just pick up a few. Another problem is we have, very often you'll see at a site a big pile of pottery where people have gone through picking up everything, got to the end of the site, and then sorted out and take one or two pieces of pottery home and then leave all the rest concentrated in a big pile, which again throws off all of your attempts to try to find cultic areas or domestic areas or industrial areas on the site. Okay, a couple comments about archaeological excavations. There are basically two types. One, long-term, well-planned projects, which are often concentrating on particular periods or particular problems within those periods. And the second type of excavation, hopefully that first type leads to fairly rapid publication, although that's not very often the case. The second type is salvage projects, which are always coming up unexpectedly and must be completed very quickly, usually within a matter of 2 or 3 days or 2 or 3 weeks. At the very most. The nature of excavations has changed very much over the past 15 to 20 years. In the early days, in both Jordan and in Palestine, you would find that your early archaeologists were usually either architects or pottery experts. And their field of concentration was usually on the biblical period. That's really how archaeology started, more or less, in this part of the world, was biblical scholars coming in and wanting to dig biblical sites. Because of this type of emphasis, you'll notice that the early publications are really dominated by the analysis of architecture and pottery typology. And you'll also notice that, not that the early or late periods were totally neglected, but basically not very much was done, certainly in Jordan, in the prehistoric periods, that is from the Paleolithic times, 500,000 to 1 million years ago, right down through the Chalcolithic period, or from the later periods following, say, the Byzantine period, the late Islamic period. So it's an interesting phenomenon that Ottoman pottery, which may be only 200 or 300 years old, we have a harder time dating that pottery accurately than we do with middle bronze pottery, for instance, or late bronze pottery, which is several thousand years old, simply because so much work is concentrated on those earlier so-called biblical periods. That is rapidly changing now. In fact, some people might say today that we have too many historians working on Jordan. This is a friendly argument that goes back between archaeologists, which is more important, the prehistoric period or the Bronze Age or the Roman period. But certainly there are a number of people now working in Jordan in the prehistoric period. Our own annual professor, Gary Rollison, who teaches up at Dartmouth, has done probably more work in Jordan in the last 5 years in the prehistoric period than anybody else. The new assistant director at the British Institute, Andrew Gerard, is also a prehistorian. The Jordanians themselves now are sending some people over for doctoral degrees in prehistory, and we'll see a slide of one of those fellows in just a minute. Also, the later Islamic periods are starting to be investigated more thoroughly and more systematically than was the case just a few years ago. One other rather dramatic change in the way in which archaeologists approach an excavation is that whereas a few years ago the ceramicist, the architect, and a photographer might be the main staff members, a modern excavation today will very often have a geologist on the team, a human osteologist, a zoologist, a paleobotanist, if they're smart, a lithics expert, an epigrapher, a hydrologist. I should mention, and maybe stop, you could go on an ethnographer and so forth. That at least is the ideal that everybody is striving for. On the other hand, a real limiting factor comes back to the finances. When you have a staff of 20 experts working on your project, most of those experts are professional established scholars in the United States, and they might not expect to be paid to work on an excavation, but at least they expect to have their airfare paid over. And so projects which were operating on budgets of around $5,000 to $10,000 20 years ago, now the average budget, I would say, for a project of involving, say, 50 staff members, which is a fairly large group that includes volunteers, will have a budget of at least $50,000 to $100,000. That's for 6 to 8 weeks of work. So it's become a very expensive proposition. And with the growing number of specialists working on the site, one thing that you have seen happening is that you might still work on a big site, but the areas of excavation are being cut down. That is, you aren't trying to expose horizontally the entire site. You're digging smaller trenches, but analyzing the cultural material within those trenches much more extensively than was being done a few years ago. In fact, I think that's probably a very good thing to happen, since although we think of ourselves as having come a long way and that archaeological research today is much more sophisticated than it was a few years ago, on the other hand, by digging at in small areas of a site, at least we are preserving the site so that 50 years from now, when our technology and our techniques have improved, somebody will have something to dig. And that's one of the problems with some of the big sites in Palestine, is that the early archaeologists got so carried away that they stripped entire layers of the site. And of course, there's no way now to go back and to test their results by new improved excavation methods. Whereas the early archaeologists were concentrating primarily on questions of chronology, very often biblical chronology, the emphasis these days is much more on trying to reconstruct what political institutions were like, or what the social structure of ancient groups was, what their diet was, what diseases they suffered from, what their agricultural industry was like, what the climatic conditions were like in different periods, what the settlement patterns were like, what the migration patterns were, and so forth. So we're getting much more down now to what life in ancient times was like, what everyday life was like, not simply the rise and fall of ancient kingdoms. Okay, that's enough, I think, comments on the surveys and excavations. As I mentioned, we'll be going in the weeks to come into much greater detail in each particular period. So now, if we could knock off all the lights, we'll start right into the slides. Okay.
Okay, this, whoops. At this point, I really don't know how far we're gonna get with all these slides, but we'll try to go as quickly as possible. This is an example of some of the earliest types of tools you find here in Jordan. A few years ago, you would often hear people say that the history of Jordan goes back at least 300,000 years. And in fact, this little Franciscan guidebook to Jordan starts at 300,000 BC, either before Christ or before the Common Era. I should mention two things that can be confusing when you're talking about chronology here. You will sometimes find dates in BC and AD, sometimes BCE, which means before Common Era, and sometimes BP, which is before the present. So if you have a site dating 2000 BP, before the present, that of course is 0 AD, or the time of Christ, or something is 4000 BP, that's 2000 BC, so you might just want to be watching for that. Hand axes have been found, we know, going back at least, according to Gary Rellis and some of the sites that he's seen out around Azraq, to 500,000 years ago. This is actually not that old an example. Rami Huri and I were just down at Pella this last week and visiting some wadis to the north of Pella where Linda Villiers is working. And she thinks that occupation in that particular wadi may well go back to 1 million years ago. So that's where we are right now with the, as far as the, what's known as the Old Stone Age or the Paleolithic period. Just show you one other example here that we've got in our case. This is an extremely large hand axe from the Jordanian desert. Usually they're about half that size. If you read the literature, the main lower Paleolithic sites, and should mention the fact that the Paleolithic period, or the Old Stone Age, is divided into three periods, roughly, the lower being the earliest, the middle, and then the upper. Lower Paleolithic people will vary on the dates, but say roughly between 1 million years ago here in Jordan to 125,000 years ago, some people would put it a little bit later. The middle Paleolithic, roughly from 125,000 to 35,000 years ago. And then the upper Paleolithic from 35,000 years ago up until about 17,000 years ago. Now, if you look at your chronology sheets afterwards, you'll notice that that varies from what Paul Lapp spoke about, and we can go into that later. The main Paleolithic sites that you hear about are at Jaffer and Kilwa, which are both further to the south. The new sites that are coming up around Pella in the Jordan Valley. And this particular hand axe is lower Paleolithic, but it's not found in an area that's generally described as a lower Paleolithic area. It's from near Kasr Harana, where there is a well-known upper Paleolithic site. But most any place you go in Jordan, especially if you're looking in wadis or washes, it's possible to find lower Paleolithic hand axes. This is a close-up shot of that hand axe and another hand axe a little bit later, a little bit finer made, also from the Harana area. This is a picture of most of the people at Sager, or at least some of the people. Laura Hess, our administrator, Scott Ralston, who used to be our administrator, Gary Rollison, our annual professor, my wife Linda, and then two Brits who were working with us on this particular survey. Scott's been conducting a survey of the Wadi by ear. If you want to get to there, you go to Katrana, roughly, and then turn to the southeast and drive for about 75 or 80 kilometers through the desert, and you'll be there. That is, if you don't take any wrong turns. If you take wrong turns like we did a couple months ago, you'll end up in Saudi. This is what the Wadi Bayir looks like today. It's very similar to the other flint desert regions in Jordan, although it looks very desolate today. 20,000 years ago, this seemed to have been quite a garden spot, and going back even further. Most of the flints that you find in this particular region date to the Upper Paleolithic period, so roughly 35,000 to 17,000 years ago. We know that there have been rather dramatic changes from the time of the Old Stone Age until today. If you can imagine when people were living out here, say 35,000 years ago, this ground probably would have been covered with shrub and grass similar to what you see in Oklahoma or western Kansas today. The dry wadi beds would have been flowing streams, and these large mud flats or desert ghahs would have been nice, large freshwater lakes. And in fact, if you want to find sites in the deserts, that's one of the easiest ways to do it, is that is to walk by the dried up wadi beds or around the fringes of the Gah, where ancient settlement tended to concentrate. This is one of the most impressive prehistoric sites in Jordan, even though it might not look like it from the surface. In fact, you can see a number of people didn't even recognize it as a site and drove right over it. It's an example of what we call a deflated tell. That is, it did build up with cultural debris over a period of probably around 5,000 years. It's also Upper Paleolithic and what's known as Epipaleolithic, that is, after the Stone Age. So it runs roughly from about 17,000 years ago until about 10,000 years ago.
Where was it?
This is what's known usually in the literature simply as the flint site at Karana, Castle Karana. It's located about 2 kilometers to the south of the Umayyad castle. This is what the surface looks like, or looked like at least in 1975. Again, there have been a lot of people collecting flint from the surface, so it's not as dense as it used to be. But all of this flint, which, again, from where you're sitting, might look like it's natural, it's all man-made tools and flakes. Again, roughly dating from 17,000 years ago to 10,000 years ago. This fellow is Mujahid Mahasin. He's a Jordanian who's studying prehistory now in France. He came out to the Harana flint site a year ago to put in a very small sounding to recover flint material that would become the basic corpus for his dissertation. Out of this very small sounding, he ended up with something like 25,000 flint chips and tools that are going to be part of his dissertation. But perhaps most surprisingly, he came down on this burial here, a human burial. There were also what appear to be intentional animal burials at a higher level on both sides, and what appears to be another human burial on this wall. What's startling about this is the oldest burial that we know of. Initially, it was thought that it might be as old as 17,000 BC. Now, the most recent carbon radiocarbon dates that they've got back indicate that it is around 12,000 BC, but still the earliest skeletal material that's been found in Jordan. And it appears quite likely that the Harana flint site at an earlier period was in fact used as a burial ground. He's going to be doing some more excavations, but it'll be interesting to find if this is simply an isolated burial or just one of many. You can see the spine along here, the rib cage, and the top of the skull with the head or the chin lying down along the chest. It's very difficult to see since it's in the shadow, but also along with this burial are two animal horns, which seem to have been intentionally placed right around the top of the skull. According to Scott Ralston, the human osteologist who's looked at the bones, he feels that it's probably that of a 28-year-old young man who was suffering from fairly advanced arthritis. My problem with this carousel, it's one of these that has extra small slots, so they don't always advance. Okay, we skipped over a few, but it's all right. This is in the northern part of Jordan. If you go into the desert, you'll notice straight east and south of here, you'll have primarily flint desert until you get down around the Wadi Rum area where you start getting the sandy deserts. In the north, however, you have the basalt flows coming off of the Jebel Druze. And this is typical of what you'll find, very low mounds with large chunks of basalt. And this is what I was describing earlier as a desert daw, which would have been a lake in prehistoric times with settlements scattered around the edges of the lake. Even today, when you get an exceptionally rainy winter, these gods will fill up with water. Along with the prehistoric sites, all the way from lower Paleolithic up to upper Paleolithic, you also find out in these basalt regions rocks that have writing on them, graffiti, and also very often drawings of humans and animals. Most of these inscriptions can be dated roughly to the Roman period, to the Safidic and Talmudic tribes, although there are some inscriptions that are very similar, or at least animal drawings, in Kilwa, which are in close association with some upper Paleolithic material. So it's conceivable that we do have animal drawings from as early as the upper Paleolithic period, but that's, since that's being dated just on surface finds and patina on the rock, that's not too certain. Moving from the upper Paleolithic to the epipaleolithic, and this is where it will be confusing on your chronological list, because LAP refers to this period as the Mesolithic, which is a term often used to describe the periods in Europe, but since a very different thing was happening here, climatic changes were not quite as drastic or had quite the impact that they had in Europe. People here have tended to discard the term Mesolithic or Middle Paleolithic and go instead with the Epipaleolithic, which means just an extension of, or that which comes after the Paleolithic. This is the little valley around the site of Veda, which is one of the more important Epipaleolithic, and then it goes on into the early Neolithic period, up until around 6000 BC. It was excavated by Diana Kirkbride in the 60s, and she is coming back to excavate again this coming spring. As you can see, the houses, there are circular houses, also rectangular houses, trapezoidal houses, and for structures which are at least 8,000 years old and earlier, they're in an amazing state of preservation.
Where is the baby?
The question was, where is Beta? It's located down near Petra, but you have to turn off before you get to Petra, like maybe 10 kilometers north of Petra, you turn to the west. Go down through nice little olive groves and then into the valley. This, some of you I'm sure have heard of this particular site. It's the site of Ain Ghazal, which has been known for several years but never excavated until this last winter by Dr. Gary Rollison, initially working with Al Leonard, both of whom were NEH fellows here at ACOR. This is Crystal Bennett, the director of the British Institute in Basel, Tennessee. As you can see, the site came to light, really, when a big parking lot was bulldozed into it. So a good deal of the site has already been destroyed, not only by this parking lot, but by the major road that runs by Ain Ghazal. It's located on the east edge of town, very near the sewage treatment plant, right before you get to the big interchange leading up to Marka and the other way on to Zarka. It's not too clear from this particular picture, but this is all natural soil, natural deposit. All of this, these layers up here, and if you look very closely, you can see some wall lines, is cultural debris. Up until the discovery of Ain Ghazal, Deda and Jericho in the Jordan Valley were the most important Neolithic sites. Now, in the Neolithic period, we're dealing roughly from about 8,000 BC to usually 4,300 BC, dates like this. Ain Ghazal is what is referred to as a pre-pottery Neolithic site, or PPNB, and dates from 7,000 to 6,000 BC, just for that 1,000-year period, and is abandoned right around 6,000 BC when pottery is just starting to come in. We do have, in fact, some clay figurines from Ain Ghazal, but no real ceramic forms. One of the things that drew the attention of the archaeologists to the site are these very small white bands, which are in fact plaster floors, again dating to the early Neolithic period. They're in an amazing state of preservation. A step trench was dug into this site up the slope, and unfortunately many of the rooms that were uncovered, we found that the bulldozer had taken most of the room, leaving you with a few feet of plaster floor and then the exterior wall. But the plaster floors are in an amazing state of preservation, so stable that once they were uncovered, you could wash them, clean them up, and walk over them like a modern plaster floor. Also, interestingly enough, in these rooms, it was found that very often you would find a depression, which doesn't show on this particular floor, but a depression which was used as a hearth, and almost invariably, just within 1 meter of the hearth, there was a burial that was placed under the floor. This seems to be a definite pattern that's starting to come out now. In several of the burials, the skulls were not found, and we're not certain why that is. It may have been simply that the bulldozers had taken the skulls at some of the burials. But during this period, the pre-pottery Neolithic B, at Jericho, some of the burials were found not to have the skulls, and the skulls were found separately, having been plastered and having cowrie shells put in the eyes. So there's a possibility that that kind of a discovery will be made at Ain Ghazal soon also, but so far we have no plastered skulls. I don't have very many pictures of Ain Ghazal since the excavation took place so recently, but this was one find underneath the corner of one wall. It's evidently a bundle of flint blanks. They have not been made into tools yet, but are blanks that could be easily made into tools. Question is still whether this was some kind of an offering that was placed under the wall at the time of its erection, or if somebody was hiding these or just swirling them away for later use. This, I'm afraid, is a very bad picture, but it's the only one I've got of a chalcolithic site. One of the most important things that takes place in the Neolithic period is the so-called Neolithic Revolution, which was the agricultural revolution. Before the Neolithic period, throughout the Old Stone Age and the Middle Stone Age, people were hunters and gatherers, that is, depending on wild animals, very often on herds of large wild animals. So they were not stationary, they were always on the move, following the wild animals and harvesting the wild plants wherever they could find them. During the Neolithic period, for the first time, possibly in the Epipaleolithic, but definitely in the Neolithic period, people started to domesticate both animals and plants. And of course, that led to a stationary, agrarian type of settlement and allowed for the first time cities to become established, or at least villages. Let's not talk in terms of cities yet. Also, we should note that at the end of the early Neolithic period, around 6,000 BC, you find evidently that the eastern desert of Jordan is inhabited for the final time. It is true that in the Umayyad period, you do have the desert castles being built, but there were evidently rather dramatic climatic changes that took place around 6,000 BC. And after that period, you don't find signs of dense population as you did in the earlier period. One other phenomenon I might mention in the desert, during the Neolithic period, you'll often find what are referred to as desert kites, which from the air look like kites on the ground. They're very low walls. There's still a debate as to what their function was, but they were probably used in the hunting of gazelle and other animals. Okay, by the time you get to the Chalcolithic period, some interesting things take place. A lot of your Neolithic sites are more or less abandoned. In fact, a lot of them are abandoned before the end of the Neolithic period, right around 6,000 BC. In the Chalcolithic period, a few years ago, almost all of the known Chalcolithic sites were in the Jordan Valley. Now, because of the results of surveys, more and more Chalcolithic sites are showing up in the plateau. This is a typical Chalcolithic site in the sense that it's located near a nice spring, very low ground, usually not fortified. That is, they would have little house walls, but no defense walls enclosing the site. Unfortunately, you very seldom find a lot of architectural features when you dig a Chalcolithic site. This is a picture of the bulk at Tel Gasul, which is one of the most important Chalcolithic sites here in Jordan, located at the northern end of the Dead Sea. And you can see the stratigraphy quite clearly here, the different ash layers going down through the Chalcolithic period and, in fact, into the Neolithic period, according to the most recent findings of the Australian expedition under Basil Hennessy. Along with small village Chalcolithic settlements, you find in the southern Gor and all the way down to Wadi Araba these tombs, which are perhaps best described as megalithic. This is a meter stick, so 3 feet high. You can see how large these rocks are. In fact, very, very little pottery has been found in association with these so-called megalithic cairn tombs. But the pottery that you find most frequently around them is Chalcolithic in date, and so it may well be that they do date to the Chalcolithic period. In the Jordan Valley especially, you'll find these little structures, very often with two big slabs on the side, a big stone slab across the top, and a big stone slab in the back. They're known as dolmens, and again, there's quite a debate as to the time period of which dolmens date, since very little pottery has been found in association with them. The dating generally runs from the Neolithic period right through the Bronze Age, or at least through EB4. When you get at the end of the Chalcolithic period, you find a major change taking place. Instead of having low-lying, unfortified farming sites around 2900, 2800 BC, the end of so-called EB1, the beginning of EB2, you find major fortified settlements, and for the first time, scholars will begin to talk about an urban period in Palestine and Jordan. This was also internationally a very interesting time. It's a time of the establishment of the Old Kingdom and the building of the Great Pyramids in Egypt. Also up in Mesopotamia, writing is invented about this time. This particular site is, in fact, right at the very beginning of the early Bronze Age. I've just got a couple of shots. It's a site that's found pretty much isolated in the northern panhandle of Jordan. It's known as Jawa, and one of the most distinctive things about this site is this huge EB1 or late Chalcolithic dam. Dr. Sven Helms, who's presently in the country working in the Jordan Valley, has excavated at Jawa and done quite a reconstruction of the water catchment system. In fact, I hope that we can arrange a trip up to this site while Sven is here. This is a close-up view of the defense wall at Jawa, which encircles the site on the inside. I don't have pictures of that, but there are standing structures, domestic structures, with corbelling, with the actual roofs of the houses made with basalt beams still intact. It's really an amazing state of preservation for a site that is over 5,000 years old. One of the reasons, of course, is that it is so isolated that the site has not been disturbed to a very great extent by nearby settlement. This particular fellow is one of the early explorers in Jordan. He came over in 1924 with William Albright from Jerusalem, and as I was mentioning earlier, the early archaeologists were very often biblical scholars, and this old fellow, M.G. Kyle, came to Jordan in search for Sodom and Gomorrah, and he went down to the southern end of the Dead Sea. They did discover during that trip the site of Bab Adra that Tom Schaub was speaking about just a few days ago, but they didn't do much excavation. Dr. Schaub and Rast have done the excavation since 1975, and with LAP working before them in 65 and 67. This is a recent burial, which you can see is excavated in 1981. It's one of the best examples that we have of an EB1A tomb. That's roughly 3,200 to 3,100 BC. At Bab Adra, at the beginning of the early Bronze Age, you don't seem to have the establishment of the great fortified city. The early burials that you find seem to be those primarily of semi-nomadic people who are probably just living at the site seasonally. And the actual town is not established then until around 2800 BC. You can see in this particular picture some very well preserved matting. It's extremely fragile, but from this we know that the burials were very often placed on top of reed mats. And in this particular case, you can see this, what looks like charred remains are the remains of nice linen cloth that were covering the woman in this particular case. Skeptical. I don't know exactly how certain they can be about the noses and the lips and some of the soft tissue, but Don Ortner, who has been doing this work, insists that you can be fairly certain. Okay, at the end of the Early Bronze III period, a rather dramatic thing happened in Palestine, and we still don't know exactly why. Around 2300 BC, these major fortified early bronze 2 and 3 cities which had grown up seem to have been bumped off one after the other. There are a lot of different theories. It could have been the Amorites coming in, or it could have been possibly just internal strife, cities fighting and destroying other cities. If that were the case, it was very effective because they almost all destroyed each other. There does seem to be fairly good evidence for somebody coming in from the outside and attacking the early bronze settlements. In EB4 then, roughly 2300 BC to about 2100 BC, Jordan goes through a period of decline, you might say, in the sense that your cities do not appear to be re-inhabited. There's more of a reverting to a semi-nomadic type of tradition. A few years ago, people would have said that more or less without hesitation. We're finding more and more examples which seem to indicate that perhaps in EB4, things had not declined as rapidly as we thought before. There's not much evidence of settlement in EB4, and not a great deal of evidence for burials.
This is why this last summer, with the excavation of the site of Umbagal, which is located just to the west of Amman, this particular cemetery was very important. They're putting a reservoir in here and entirely wiping out this hill. And in fact, the hill is gone now. And in the process, they started coming across a number of tombs, all of which seem to date to the EB4 or beginning of Middle Bronze Age, roughly between 2000 BC, maybe as early as 2100 BC. Pottery is very homogeneous, indicating that it was used rather intensively for 100 or 200 years, but not beyond that. This is an example of one of the chambers here. Very often we didn't get the chambers until they had been already almost half destroyed. Here you see the shaft going down, a blocking stone, and a chamber, half of which has disappeared in the scoop of the front loader. Here's another tomb right behind that particular chamber, and this is a shaft going down as we were going into a chamber here. One thing is very obvious, it's like the Baba Draw Cemetery in the sense that it's very well organized. A lot of these tombs were cut within a half meter of each other, and sometimes layered. You'd have a tomb down here and then a tomb coming down just near the roof. Obviously, whoever was cutting these tombs knew exactly where the previous tombs had been. This is a typical find, a four-spouted lamp. Almost every tomb that we had these particular lamps, which are very typical of the end of the Early Bronze Age and the beginning of the Middle Bronze Age. This particular lamp was extremely interesting. We did find, in the course of the excavation of these tombs, that there was very often a little niche, and we thought that that might be a niche that the lamps had been placed in. In this particular case, you could still see smoke blackening the top of that little niche. So evidently, or at least according to our theory at this point, while the people were cutting out the tombs, they were probably using these little four-spouted lamps for light. All of them showed burn marks that they had been used at one point or another. And once the burial was deposited, they probably just left it. Okay, with all the emphasis on the nomadic or semi-nomadic character of the EB4 period following the urban EB3 period, there are some exceptions which have a tendency to throw off all of our theories. And one of these is the Early Bronze IV site of Kirbit Iskander, located in the Wadi Wala. There is a project that's working on this site presently. At least they are coming over every other year. The site, the extent of the site is right here, this dark patch. It does have earlier occupation in the Early Bronze period, but it's predominantly EB4 in date. And one of the things that has come up in the last two seasons of excavation are a series of rather massive walls. Now these may date to the EB3 period, but they appear, at least at this time, to be EB4 walls. So we've got an EB4 fortified site, whereas supposedly during the EB4 period, people weren't building fortifications. Another very important site for this transitional period between EB4 and the beginning of the Middle Bronze Age at around 2100 or 2050 BC, some people will put it up, is a very small tell located near Pella, or Tabaka Faho, about 7 or 8 kilometers to the west of Tabaka Faho. It's a site known as Tel Hayat. There's been one season of excavation thus far, and the team is coming back to excavate this spring, early summer. It seems to be typical of what is emerging now, that we are finding more and more EB4, MB1 sites, and they appear to be quite small, low mounds. This mound is no more than about 3 meters high. So although in the end of the Early Bronze IV period, beginning of the Middle Bronze, you don't have a total nomadic way of life, it does seem that you had a number of small agricultural settlements, probably very similar to what was occurring in the Chalcolithic period. Just to identify the people here quickly, this is Steve Faulkner, and Bonnie Magnus Garner, who are the co-directors of the project. Hazi Bishop is with the Department of Antiquities in charge of excavations. He oversees all Jordanian and foreign excavations, and himself is working at Qasr Halabat, the Mayan site in the north, and Dr. Adnan Hadidi, the Director General of the Department of Antiquities. Okay, this is the first shot for the Iron Age period, and I think since we're right at 7:30 now, we'll go ahead and break and pick up the Iron Age next time. All right? If anybody has questions, you can ask them now, or I will be around for a few minutes to discuss anything. What's that?
Your late Bonnie stuff.
Ah. Yeah, I should. In fact, you're right.